From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the return of Richard C. Hoagland with some incredible space stories. Tomorrow night, by the way, on our program during our news segment, intention experimenter Lynn McTaggart joins us. She is going to do an intention experiment on Russia, Ukraine, and hopefully this might put an end to this madness. I want you to participate in this experiment. That'll be in our news segment tomorrow night. Here's what's happening. Russia's strategy in its war in Ukraine is shifting now toward a slow annihilation of the Ukrainian military. Russia could focus on a bloody and deadly bombardment of cities and civilian targets as the conflict becomes a grinding war of attrition now. Ukrainian forces have so far been able to stave off Russia's initial push, maintaining control of Kyiv and other major cities. They lost one city today, but they remain massively outgunned and outmanned. Howard Bloom is checking in on the story for us today. Howard, what are your thoughts?
Well, that's a good summation, but things are not going well for Vladimir Putin in the Ukraine. Putin has taken, as you pointed out, only one Ukrainian city, the southern city of Kherson. A week ago, Putin apparently intended to take Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, in 24 hours. It's 7 days later, and Kyiv is still stubbornly resisting Vladimir Putin's army. To solve this problem, Putin has sent a 40-mile-long convoy of military trucks, artillery, vacuum bombs, rocket launchers, and tanks to Kyiv, which is an overwhelming force. But that convoy has been bogged down for 24 hours, making no progress. Now Putin is apparently getting frustrated. If Ukrainians will not come out on the streets and welcome his troops with flowers, he will smash their cities to bits. So increasingly, Russia is attacking civic buildings and apartment buildings, driving nearly a million women and children to flee to neighboring countries. Meanwhile, the economic sanctions that we and our allies have imposed are taking their toll. The ruble has plunged. A year ago, a ruble was worth 20 cents. Today, a ruble is worth less than a penny.
Wow.
People are waiting for hours at ATM machines to yank out their savings. That's an early sign of an economic crash. And over 6,500 people have been arrested for demonstrating against Putin's war in over 35 Russian cities. Demonstrations are also flourishing on Twitter and Telegram. One Russian-language online petition to stop the war has gotten more than a million signatures and is still climbing. 145 members of the UN General Assembly today have voted to demand that Russia stop the war. Topping it all off, a Russian businessman has offered a bounty of $1 million to any Russian military officer who does his constitutional duty and arrests Vladimir Putin as a war criminal. But to understand Putin's war in the Ukraine, you have to understand why Vladimir Putin feels that the destiny of all of humankind is in his hands. In 312 AD, the Roman Emperor Constantine saw a vision of the cross in the sun, and a few years later made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. Constantine also moved the capital of the Roman Empire from the original city of Rome in Italy to a city approximately 1,400 miles to the east, the city of Byzantium. So in Russian lore, the first Rome was Rome, and the second Rome was Byzantium. Byzantium was more than just the new capital of the Roman Empire. It was the city through which God transmitted his orders to humanity. It was the center of Orthodox Christianity. What's more, Byzantium was a huge success. It was the linchpin of the Roman Empire and of God on earth for an astonishing 1,200 years. Then in 1453, Byzantium fell to the Muslims and was renamed Istanbul. At that moment of catastrophe, the Russians felt that God's contact point on earth had moved to, brace yourself, Moscow. Russians were certain that Moscow was the third Rome, the third center of Christianity and of world civilization, which meant that Moscow had a destiny to rule all of humankind. And one of the men Vladimir Putin apparently listens to most is named Alexander Dugin. Dugin is the founder of Eurasianism, a philosophy that says that the Russian people appeared before any other people on the planet and hence deserve to rule. Dugin preaches that Russia's role is to defeat the United States and become leader of the planet. A leader of the planet will cleanse the earth of the ungodly sin that Dugin calls liberalism. By liberalism, Dugin means democracy and human rights. It is highly likely that Dugin's philosophy is churning through Vladimir Putin's mind as he plots his moves in Ukraine, and it is highly likely that Dugin's ideas are in Putin's mind as he demands control of all of the Eastern European nations that were once part of the Soviet Union. So it is highly likely that Dugin's ideas are in Putin's mind as Putin unfolds his moves to take nearly 40% of Europe.
Once again, thank you, Howard. And once again, Lynn McTaggart joins us in our news segment tomorrow night with an intention experiment. We need you to participate, where she's going to attempt to put an end to this Russian-Ukraine conflict. U.S. and European stocks rebounded on Wednesday, and crude prices surged past $110 a barrel as fighting raged in Ukraine for the seventh day, posing a challenge for central banks hoping to curb rising inflation. Registered investment advisor Mish Shedlock with us. Mish, when is this going to get better?
Well, it will. The question is how. Oil prices are up again. Apologies, I've got a little bit of a cold here, so I hope I sound okay.
You sound fine. You sound good.
Crude's 114 now, and it's 117 Brent in Europe as we speak. The president gave a speech last night I thought was kind of lukewarm at best. He pledged to do something about inflation, but it seemed to me, George, that everything he offered was just going to add more inflation. And the one thing he did say, he was going to tap the strategic oil reserves. George, that's only a two-day supply.
Exactly.
And what if we really need that? I think it's the wrong thing to do, George. I just do. And then all eyes are on the Fed. For some reason, the stock market seemed to like what Powell had to say today. Well, essentially the message was he's going to be a little bit more cautious. They're only going to do a 25 basis point hike in March, not 50 as some expected. I don't know if I see any of that as good news. If we look ahead at the oil futures, the December futures right now are only $86. But that doesn't mean that oil is going to come down to 86 in December, because the December futures were 65 at the beginning of this year. So we'll see. Soybeans are up another $16. Wheat's up.
Everything's up.
Everything is up. And, you know, both the Fed and Biden are pretending that they can do something about this, George. I don't believe they can.
Talk to you next week, Mish. Amazon.com said it plans to close all 68 of its brick-and-mortar bookstores, pop-ups, and shops carrying toys and home goods in the United States and the United Kingdom, ending some of its longest-running retail experiments. Didn't work. Donald Trump advisor John Eastman's emails may have evidence of at least three crimes that the former president and his associates may have committed, according to a House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection, as they said in a court filing, urging a judge to reject Eastman's request to block the release of the communications. It's the first public signal that the committee is looking into criminal activity by those within Trump's inner circle. The mystery surrounding why prehistoric Brits built Stonehenge has finally been solved after research confirmed that the monument served as an ancient solar calendar. Professor Timothy Darvall concluded the site was designed as a calendar based on a solar year of 365.25 days, helping people keep track of the days, weeks, and months. That's pretty accurate in those days. Up next, Black Ops, the life of a CIA shadow warrior. We'll be talking with Rick Prado next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about our special guest for the next couple hours. He will be with us, Enrique Rick Prado, spent a legendary 24-year career in the Central Intelligence Agency during the Cold War and the Age of Terrorism. Mr. Prado received the CIA Distinguished Career Intelligence Medal and the George Bush Award for Excellence in Counterterrorism. He's a paramilitary, counterterrorism, and special clandestine operations specialist. Served as an operations officer in six overseas posts, and upon leaving public service, he worked as an executive at a private military contractor where he built a specialized operations team. Currently the co-owner of Camp X Training, where he continues his service training and supporting the Spec Ops community, teaching advanced special operations and techniques, among other essential skills. His book is called Black Ops, The Life of a CIA Shadow Warrior. And Rick, I got to tell you, fascinating book. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, George.
Born in Cuba.
Born in Cuba.
You went through everything as a young boy. You saw the Castro takeover and everything else, didn't you?
Yes, you know, and that beginning, I think, has a lot to do with where I ended my career in. I was 7 years old when the revolution started attacking the town that I lived in, which was at the foothills of the mountains where Che Guevara was leading the guerrilla rebels there at the time. And I literally saw several firefights, one right in front of my face. I was standing by the window. So I saw violence early. I saw war. But that's not as bad as seeing what happened once Castro took over, because very shortly thereafter, he declared himself a communist and started confiscating all the businesses, closing down the churches, all the atrocities. I saw firsthand, men hanging from trees by their neck with signs around their neck saying, counter-revolutionary. Persecutions were all over. The political parties were destroyed. So I think that experience, when you're 7, 8, 9 years old, I left Cuba when I was 10 in 1962. I think living under that and seeing what they did to my first country and what it did to my family kind of planted that seed that this is a monster that needs to be fought. I was lucky enough to get out in 1962, and came to the United States by myself. I was an only child. My dad put me on an airplane to get me to the United States, not knowing if he was ever going to see me, and definitely not for financial benefit. It was definitely for freedom. My dad did not want his only child to grow up in such an oppressive regime.
But your dad was not a Batista fan earlier, was he?
No, he was not. My dad was not a Batista fan at all. But my dad was a hardworking man. We had a nice little business. You know, when Castro took over in 59, my dad had a 57 Chevy, a TV, and a phone in our home. So we were solid middle class in Cuba. That went away really quick. First, by confiscation of his coffee roasting company. And second, when he declared, because you had to declare, hey, I'm getting a passport, means you're leaving, they froze, like to everybody else, they froze all their bank accounts, and they come to your house, and they inventory your house, and everything that's there, knife, fork, spoons, pots, and pans, has to be there the day that you're going to leave. If not, they don't let you leave.
Jeez, it's crazy times. And I guess, Batista was not a Boy Scout by any means. I think he was a crook myself, Rick. But Castro disappointed a lot of people, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I think he fooled a lot of people. He didn't fool my grandfather. My grandfather was not a Batista guy, but I remember. There's things that as a child you remember. I remember my mom and grandfather, my maternal grandfather, speaking in front of me, and he's saying to my mom, "This man will be the ruin of this country." And my mom say, "Oh no, how can you say that, Dad?" And this was like, February of 59.
About Castro, he was saying.
Yes, right? That's right.
Wow. Well, I want to come back to the Cuban situation, but let's get your reaction, Rick, as a CIA operative to this situation in Ukraine and Russia. My gosh, it's out of control.
It is, what surprises me is that a lot of people are surprised that this is happening. You have to understand, George, that, communism since the very beginning, 1917, and even before, the mentality of the Russian mentality has been one of controlling the people and expanding the kingdom. For us to be surprised that Putin is trying to move and broaden his Russia into the realm of the Soviet Union of years past, he as much as said it when he first took over. So I think that what we need to understand is that this is a monster. I call it an octopus because that sort of reminds me of those tentacles reaching out to Latin America through Cuba, the Nicaragua thing, which I was very much involved
right.
in. It is an octopus that we have to be fighting all the time, not necessarily with guns and bullets, but trying to keep them in check, because there is no doubt in my mind that he will, whatever he gains out of this, even if he stops right now, he's got the eastern provinces. And we call that creeping normalcy. Well, he'll take a piece of land or a particular argument to a point where, okay, if I stop here, he knows the mentality, Western mentality. 6 months later, people forget that those provinces were once part of Ukraine.
That's right. Now, that's absolutely, civilians are dying, but a lot of Russian soldiers are being killed. They want to go home. It's a bad situation all around, Rick.
Yeah, it is bad, and it's pleasantly bad for him. For us, I was pleasantly surprised because, you know, there's a saying that amateurs practice tactics and experts practice logistics. And when I saw that convoy sitting there, which is still sitting there, and I hear that the soldiers only had 3 or 4 days' worth of meals. I'm sorry, I was in the military. I know that the military moves on his stomach. People are don't want to be in that fight. And they are getting a resistance from the Ukrainians that they did not expect. And this speaks volumes of what we stand for, which is freedom. Communism, again, is the antithesis of freedom. And what these Ukrainian military guys have proven is that they are going to fight. Now, Putin can bomb the hell out of Ukraine, and he can do all kinds of other stuff. But if he gets into a door-by-door trying to get hands through there, listen, we saw that in Fallujah. We saw that in fighting ISIS.
Yep.
When you get into that house to house, that is attrition, and he will lose a substantial number of people. And as you mentioned, one of the things that I was hearing there, you know, the ruble, what it's worth now, the fact that, you know, you can't even buy toilet paper with it, people drawing their money, the discontent. He might have bitten off more than he can chew, and I think we should capitalize, again, not militarily, but capitalize on his growing unpopularity and trying to foster that.
Yeah, he may have made a blunder on this one. What do you think our Russian CIA group is doing right now in the D.C. or at the CIA headquarters?
Oh, I'm guaranteeing you that they're working 24-hour shifts.
Are they working with Russian operatives?
Well, our Russia department, they change its names like everything else, but the group in our headquarters that is in charge of what is Russia and Eastern Europe maintain tabs and maintain contacts and takes our agents are throughout the world. So I know that we're collecting on them. That's we were doing that when I was there. I also, it's been in the news, so this is not a secret, that the United States have had some specialized individuals, mostly from the agency, training. Again, I don't have that as a fact from, I don't have access to the building anymore directly, but that's what that's what I've done in my past careers. That's what you expect them to do. Is I have a feeling that probably even a year before this ever cropped up, we were there training up the trainers, getting them to be, you know, taking their military guys and making them better and have them train the rest. And I think that's one of the results of what you're seeing is that these are not a band of French resistance guys at the beginning before the OSS started to train them. These guys are already trained by OSS-type individuals that have gone there and trained them as such. I think resupplying the Ukrainians is something that we really, really need to do. And when I say we, I don't mean the United States only. This is a global problem, and Europe has more skin in the game than anybody else because it's a monster at its door. So I think that there's no you cannot skimp on trying to float in with ammunition, medical, and whatever expertise, non-combat that you could provide.
Putin's method, of course, is disastrous, I believe. But did he have any points at all in wanting to go in and stop things?
Can you say that again, please? I'm sorry.
Putin, did he have any rationale for wanting to go into Ukraine that was legitimate?
Well, I think that's been in his bad basket from day one. I mean, remember, when he took over, he said, my goal is to reestablish the greatness of what was the Soviet Union. Well, there's only one way of doing that, and that's by annexing Poland and Czechoslovakia and Ukraine and everything that goes with it.
Yeah.
I think that what he believes is that he had an opportunity because there's not the fortitude to face him.
Hold on for a second, Rick. We're at a break. We got to squeeze this in, but we'll be coming right back. The name of the book, Black Ops, his website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Rick Prado with us. His book, Black Ops. We'll get into this book in a big way in just a moment. One more question about the Ukraine-Russian situation. Why couldn't they work this out at the table before any kind of military conflict, Rick?
Well, again, the negotiations is not their forte. They cannot make any argument and concessions that Putin is going to accept. And he's always had his finger on the military option. I think that that's his mentality and his background pushes him in that direction. So he's not afraid of war, and he is an aggressive individual. Yes, I think economic sanctions could have started a lot earlier. I think our help for the Ukrainians should have started a lot earlier. And again, when I say we, I mean the Western world, not just the United States.
Now back to your book and your work. As a CIA operative, did you have to get this book approved once you wrote it?
Yes. As a matter of fact, this book is fully approved by the agency. CIA took 6 months to approve this book. And I'm pleasantly surprised how much they allowed me to talk about. And I think that the main reason for that was the argument that I make up front with the book. Is the reason I wrote the book is primarily because after all these years working with some of the best people I've ever worked with and watching TV just like everybody else does, I got tired of the image that my agency has. It's the most malign agency in the federal government. And, you know, our heroes, our patriots, are those people that do the work that nobody even knows, are always described as immoral, treacherous, maniacal assassins like Jason Bourne that are being hunted down by their own government because of some black program, blah, 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 or selling drugs. And, you know, after 9/11, we have 137 stars on our wall of men and women in the agency that have given their lives up for what we believe in. And we owe those individuals a much better opportunity to be known and some of their exploits documented, especially after all these years. So that was the reason for the book. And like I said, I'm very, very surprised. You read it, so you know that there's quite a bit of information there that is going to be new. And, you know, you said it earlier, too, the contrast between having the Cold War, which never really went away. You're seeing it again. But the terrorism, the phenomenon, the terrorism came in, and it was like a flashbang for everybody to focus on just that.
How did you get recruited into the CIA?
You know, when I was about 20 years old, I joined a unit in the Air Force called Pararescue, which is one of our elite special operations forces in the United States.
It's like the Navy SEALs.
That is correct. Yeah. And like Green Berets, you know, we have our different expertise. We're primarily combat medics that can jump out of airplanes, do scuba, mountain climb, and all that other, and shoot and loot as necessary. But our main goal always remains bringing down down pilots or a team that goes in and it gets pinned down. In Afghanistan, we had a lot of Green Beret teams that had PJs, pararescue men, with them for that reason. So, but anyway, that during that time, I mean, I went in late 71 into pararescue, and I went because I wanted to go to Vietnam. I felt that I owed this country a debt of honor for what they've done for my family and myself, and I decided to go into the military, and fortuitously, I met somebody who introduced me to pararescue. And I did a few years with them, and then I applied to the agency. I think it was in 74. And back then, as you may recall, we were going through an incredible attrition post-Vietnam, so they very nicely told me, we're not hiring, we're firing. Tried it again in 79, and this time they asked me to start doing some contract work with them with our Special Activities Division Ground Branch, which is the CIA's Special Operations Forces, for lack of a better word, and all the people that go there come from that background. So that exposed me to CIA management, and unfortunately they were still not hiring. But then what happened was the Sandinistas they declared themselves communists. They became part of the Cuban tentacle that was engulfing Latin America and spreading into El Salvador and Guatemala and places beyond. And Reagan came to power, and he said, we are going to stop this. And we started a covert program called the Contras.
That's right. With Oliver North was part of that, wasn't he?
Yeah, slightly later on. I mean, at the very beginning, he was not. But immaterial. The covert auction was a program that, at the end, was successful because it forced the Sandinistas through military pressure, supporting the freedom fighters that were there, the Nicaraguan freedom fighters that were there, forced them to carry out a democratic election with oversight, world oversight, and the Sandinistas lost. So that was a success story for the agency and a shot in the arm for the agency.
What's happening in Nicaragua now?
They're back to square one.
That's what I thought.
I have a couple of friends in the Mosquitia, which is the eastern side, where the Native Americans there live. They're called Miskito, Sumo, and Rama are the three tribes that populate that area. And he was telling me, he says, Rick, this is as bad as it was in 1981.
Jeez.
The oppression is there. The abuse is there. The starving is there. They are blocking the roads. They are.
As soon as we leave, everything falls apart again, doesn't it?
Yeah, and again, we cannot be everywhere at the same time, but we definitely need to maintain some influence in places, especially in our backyard. I mean, you got to understand, Nicaragua and Venezuela and those kind of places, they are in our backyard. You know, the Russians are bitching that the Ukraine is a foothold by the West to threaten the mother country, blah, 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 or the fatherland, whatever the heck they call it. Well, if we adopted the same theory, which I'm not saying that we should, why don't we go to Cuba? Cuba is a surrogate, violent, aggressive surrogate of the Russians, and it's 90 miles south of our border.
Well, it absolutely is. But why is it? Is it justified, Rick, when people talk about the United States doing so many covert things in other nations? Is it justified or not?
Well, let me explain it. It is justified because it's how it's done. I mean, it's not the CIA or DIA or any of the other sister organizations from the community. These are things that are thought about and come from the White House. As a matter of fact, you know, our boss at the end of the day is the President of the United States.
Sure.
We do covert action for things like Ukraine, things like Nicaragua, things like El Salvador. We had a lot of our friends in Salvador, of my friends in Salvador, training the Salvadorians and buttressing them to try to push back the communist guerrillas that were, you know, taking over the country. So that's the kind of covert action we do. We also do covert action against terrorism. You know, we try to recruit, we try to, you know, if necessary, kidnap somebody, track them down through technology or through human sources. But the bottom line is we have to fight back. And if we sit back, Ukraine is not going to be the exception. It's going to be the rule.
We could have taken out Osama bin Laden way before 9/11. Why didn't we do that?
Yes, you know, as you mentioned, I'm a plank owner of the Bin Laden Task Force. In late 95, early 96, the agency decided that they were going to create a station dedicated strictly to Osama bin Laden. And I'm a plank owner of that. I started with Mike Scheuer. Mike Scheuer was a senior analyst, and I was a GS-15 at the time, and I was his deputy. So I was deputy chief of station. And we started making book on bin Laden. And I will tell you, in the mid-1990s, we knew where, not only did we know where bin Laden was, I could have told you what he had for lunch.
Wow.
Because we were photographing him, and he was there in a very he was in Khartoum, Sudan at the time.
Now, was this during the era where the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan?
That's how he started. He started when the Russian invasion, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. He was a mujahideen,
and we helped him.
Yes, he did. Yeah, we helped the mujahideen to fight the communism, and as a matter of fact, we gave them the tools and the training to knock back that aggression. Of course, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
That's right.
And that turned around on us, and Bin Laden is a perfect example of that. But back to the point that we had him in our sights. There was no doubt in my mind. I was seeing it every day, and that was my job as the ops guy. The scenarios that we could have used to disrupt Bin Laden in any way that you could think of, and we proposed this up the ladder time and time again, and the political fortitude wasn't there. It was, well, you know, he really hasn't done anything. Well, he's training people to do this kind of stuff. Where do you think it's going? He's dealing with very radicalized, you know, folks from all over the world. I describe Bin Laden as the scene from The Godfather. He was that guy that could reach out and touch different organizations out there, and they would do his bidding because of the money that he had and the charisma that he had. But at that time, we could have taken him out of commission, and I don't mean just killing him. We could have kidnapped him. Imagine if we would have done that. You're talking, chances are the coal bombing would have happened. The bombing of our embassies in Africa would have happened. And definitely, you know, 9/11 probably would have not happened.
Right.
And it's the same argument. You know, imagine if we had shot Hitler in 1939.
Same thing. Same kind of thing. Now, didn't Osama bin Laden come to the United States under some assumed name under our invitation? I had heard that a long time ago.
I've never heard any proof of that. I've heard the rumors, but as an intelligence officer, I can't deal in rumors.
They gave him some U.S. name like Bobby Moore or something like that.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, and you think about it, if it was a way of trying to bring him into the fold and make him an ally, it was worth a shot. But once that shot wasn't worth it, we were tasked to focus on him. And let's face it, you know, that same little unit that I helped start, which where I would think was maybe 10 of us at the time, it's the very same unit that eventually, years and years, like a couple of decades later, was able to finally pinpoint him and allow our Navy SEALs to shoot him in the face.
Once the KGB fell apart in the Soviet Union, what has replaced it now in Russia?
Well, they have their own intelligence service, and, you know, you can change the label from the outside to the other. You know, organizations like mine are supposed to be apolitical. That's the first thing they taught me at the farm. We don't do politics and we don't do policy. We collect intelligence and we carry out covert action at the direction of the United States president. And, those organizations are meant to do one thing. Now, I think that the biggest difference, which a lot of people do not understand, and again, the reason that I am so proud of the book, is, you know, the Russians and the Cubans and even the Chinese, the communist countries, that their intelligence service primarily try to recruit for weaknesses. In other words, the person that is cheating on his wife, or they put a honeypot is a big deal. It's where they send a very attractive woman to a guy who's, you know, in Germany, been there for 2 months working, and he's got access to classified material, and they, you know, she seduces him, compromises him,
and he talks,
and makes him fall.
Yeah.
We don't do that. We do not. We try to recruit for strengths, individuals that have the same convictions, whether they're in country A or country B, to help us do the right thing.
Have you ever had anybody within the CIA, Rick, go rogue, where you had problems with them?
Well, I mean, I think not necessarily rogue, but as you know, we have had individuals that were traitors. You know, they actually defected to the Soviet Union for one time. We've had people that worked for the Russians, and it's funny, none of those guys were recruited by the Russians. They volunteered.
Gee, why would they do that? Money?
Primary money. The last guy that was really involved with this, and I'm trying to remember his name because I met him several times, Nicholson.
Was there a movie about him?
I don't know.
There was a movie about a CIA operative who went to the Soviet Union, basically.
Well, there was a guy way before him, even before I got in, that went through the farm and did everything else, and then shortly thereafter, started providing information and ended up in the Soviet Union. But intelligence services will continue to be intelligence services, and there's a continuity from the KGB to now. That hasn't changed whatsoever. Nothing in Russia has changed other than the creation of these oligarchs that have this incredible power and money, which, again, it's could be a thorn on Putin's side if they get further discontent with him.
Exactly. If their money gets seized by us, who knows what could happen.
That's right. That is right.
We're going to take a quick break, Rick. We'll talk more about your book, Black Ops, The Life of a CIA Shadow Warrior. But we'll also open up the phone lines and give our incredible audience an opportunity to ask you a question or two about the CIA and some of the things that have been going on. I've got a few more questions myself. Rick Prado's website is linked up. It's his name. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And the book is brand new, Black Ops, The Life of a CIA Shadow Warrior.